Welcome to the Conference for Women teleclass, The Art of Pushing Back. Advocate for yourself successfully. We're joined today by Selena Rezvani, who is the Vice President of Consulting and Research at leadership development firm Be Leaderly, and also the author of two leadership books targeted at professional women. Selena is a regular speaker and commentator, and also authored an award-winning column for the Washington Post. And now, among other things, she writes about women and the workplace for Forbes. Selena's latest book is titled Pushback: How Smart Women Ask and Stand Up for What They Want. And today she'll dive into what she means by pushback and some strategies for getting it right. Welcome, Selena.
Well, thank you so much, Lindsay. I am thrilled to be here today to get to talk to you about my favorite leadership subject for women, and that's self-advocacy. You know, I thought I would start with a quick story from my own life that was a really meaningful advocacy moment. And it started when I was young. For my family, sending me to college was going to be a financial sacrifice. I knew that. My father had very suddenly passed away in my teenage years, and that left my mom, you know, there to need to make miracles happen. And she really did make miracles happen. When it came time for college, I received some financial aid from my top school that I wanted to go to, and my mom scraped together to cover the rest of what was needed to send me to college that first year. And I loved it. When it came time for year two, though, the financial aid package came, and it was really tiny. I realized in that moment that any positive change to this situation, any possibility that I was going to attend that school for year two and three and four, would need to come from my own actions. And so in my youth, I typed up this passionate, lengthy appeal to the financial aid office explaining the situation and here's how I will contribute to the university if you keep me on. And to my very happy shock, they changed the package dramatically and they gave me much more aid, not just that year, but all the subsequent years of my degree. And I was hooked. I was hooked on this idea, and I still am, that your voice is the ultimate tool for steering outcomes that you want in your life. For those of you listening, why should you be a self-advocate? Why care about or hone this leadership skill in front of some other skills you could be building? Well, I'll share with you a really important data point. I interviewed, for the basis of research for my book, Pushback, 20 C-level women. Talk about an awesome education those 20 hours were. But I asked the women, what percentage of a woman's career success is made up by her effectiveness pushing back and advocating for herself? And I thought the response would be affirmative, but not as affirmative as what I found. When I averaged the 20 responses I heard, the answer was 60%. So let me be clear. That's to say 60% of a woman's career success hinges on pushback skills, holding your own, advocating your needs, negotiating for what you want. You know, I heard about technical skills or business pedigree or even people management skills, but according to successful women executives, this command of your voice, the ability to advocate, ranked higher. If you think about it, we advocate all the time in our daily lives to take our PTO, you know, to be staffed on that plum work assignment. I'd argue we should advocate to dodge certain assignments or projects too, to be taken off Project Useless Town, as I call many of them. We advocate for a role we want, for a better deadline that's more reasonable, you know, a deliverable that's a better quality product from a vendor. You know, we often do this for somebody else as women. We advocate for a direct reports advancement. What we can advocate for is really pretty limitless, as I hope you'll see. So if you're somebody who sees this as a kind of once a year skill, please notice, realize the everyday skill that it is. I want to set the kind of groundwork by looking at a few advocacy styles, because I know for many of us, there's a style we know we don't want. We've seen somebody do it really badly and been turned off. On one extreme, you have passivity, where there's this appeasing kind of apologetic approach. You're basically saying to another person, your idea or stature is more important than mine. And I would argue you're almost violating your own needs and wants by not expressing yourself, taking that passive or passive aggressive approach. All the way on the other extreme is aggressiveness, where you're taking a more domineering, insistent approach. And we know these people. We've probably all been in a meeting with this kind of person. You know, this is the kind of person who's telegraphing, my needs are more important than yours. In the magic middle, where we're going to focus today, is healthy self-advocacy. This basically says, I'm okay, you're okay. It's marked by being honest, by being open and direct. And I would even say with this style, you're able to say no. How important is that? You get and you give respect with this healthy self-advocacy. And what you're really conveying is you are no more or less important than me. That's the magic. That's the sweet spot where we want to be. Today, I want to show you a few simple tools to advocate better across a few phases or, you know, general steps. And what I mean is being well prepared to be a good advocate. You know, rarely can any of us be a great self-advocate thrown on the spot or when we're engaged in a drive-by conversation. So how can you be best prepared? Once you're in the room, you're having the actual conversation, how can you navigate it smartly? You might have done all your great homework, but what are the in-the-moment considerations, you know, that can make or break that conversation? And lastly, I want to look together at following up from the conversation. You know, a lot of times we think our work is totally done. You know, I asked for what I wanted or I said my piece. In fact, that's really just the beginning. So we'll look at following up from the conversation as well. So let's look at preparation. The first thing I really implore you to do is use your leverage. These are your bargaining chips that are unique to you, what you bring to your role, your company. And I want you to keep a success log of compliments, accolades from clients and higher ups, including things like efficiencies you've created, revenue you've brought in, anything measurable. The old saying is that managers have short memories. Make it easy for them to be conversant in where you're doing really well. I want you to scan your own environment and answer this question. What do people recognize you for consistently? Out loud, as a pattern. What do they see in you as a strength that they mention, not just once, but more than once? Think about that. Now I want you to think about what you've done really well that nobody has necessarily pointed out. This is kind of treated as a non-event, but we know it has significant value. I'll give you a quick example of this. Samantha, a woman we worked with who works in energy, that field, she's known around her company for having great vision, for being a really strong idea person. That's what she's known for. But over the course of several months, she executed a realignment for her particular division, and she did it with zero turnover. That's pretty incredible in change management worlds. Pretty unheard of in her industry as well, not to lose any people over a 6-month period. This is an example of a really ripe place to begin advocating for yourself, that area where you're strong and not enough people know about it. I can guarantee for all of you, you have that same kind of value in at least one area that's going unseen or unnoticed. Think about it. I also want to say, think about the power and influence that comes from your unique properties as an employee, what you bring to the equation. Be so clear on those properties, including things like your positional power. Your technical skills, your client base, your industry contacts or knowledge, all of that matters. If it's true, I often tell women, it's not bragging. If it's true, it's not bragging. The moral of the story here is you are enough. In order to self-advocate, you don't need four more accolades or one more high-level job to ask for more responsibility, money, whatever it may be. Another important thing you can do once you've figured out your leverage is to consider the other side's GPS. This is often your boss, right, or the person you're asking. How can you think about hooking your request to their GPS, their goals, their passions, or their struggles? Okay, those are the things they're on the hook for, the things they're they care about particularly deeply. Or the pain points, right? The struggles holding them back. In one case, a woman that I interviewed, Camilla, in the financial industry, she heard her boss complain often about projections he had to come up with, including some analysis and takeaways he would add to those projections and send around to the higher-ups. Well, guess what she did? So smartly, she wrapped in her request for more responsibility his struggle, which was preparing those, and said, why don't you let me take that on? It worked beautifully. And now she is the person, you know, giving her high-level analyses to some very important people within her company. When you've considered their GPS, you've thought about your own leverage, it's time to think about tailoring the style you're going to employ in any self-advocacy kind of conversation. So think for a minute, who you find it most challenging to take a hard line with. Is there a certain personality type that's hard for you to do, to communicate with? It could be the analyzer, you know, who really thinks of every little detail, the withholder who's giving you minimal cues, the devil's advocate, we all love that person who's this never-ending fountain of probing questions. But for many people, it's the authority figure. The point here is you're going to advocate for your needs with people you like, people you love, in some cases with people you really detest. How are you going to handle it? One smart way is to tailor your approach. How does your counterpart tend to make decisions? What do they generally say yes to? You know, think about in a given day when they're particularly open and receptive, or on the flip side, when are they crabby, annoyed, kind of closed off to new ideas? If they're logical and direct and efficient in terms of their work style, then it's not going to work very well for you to come in and spend a long time on small talk, right? If they're on the other side, very relationship oriented, and you come in totally no nonsense and skip, you know, pleasantries or any rapport building, you're also going to turn them off. So really key into their preferred work style, their behavioral style, and shape your advocacy proposal around that. One of the women I interviewed, Darlene Slaughter, she's a chief diversity officer at United Way, talked about this. She said, I know the importance of finding just the right way to deliver something. I really try to make the case in my counterpart's language. She uses it so it feels like it really came right off their lips. Very smart way to get buy-in. Let's move to navigating the conversation. We've talked about three ways you can prepare smartly. What about when you're actually in the room? There's one thing that's really important, and there's a strong psychological pull in a lot of us. And by the way, this is especially hard if you're a recovering good girl like me. And that is, don't be overly deferential, even if you're negotiating with an authority figure and you're advocating for yourself. Instead, approach it more peer to peer. There's a great old saying, and it says, if you put somebody up on a pedestal, don't be surprised when they start to look down on you. Okay, so instead, think it's you and I versus the problem. We are here together, co-creating a solution to a problem together. By the way, there was a very famous study within a hospital clinic that I think illustrates this beautifully. And what they found was that women who were having medical encounters, who reported repeating information to doctors, asking their doctors questions about things they didn't understand, even reminding their doctors about upcoming tests that they were likely to have, those individuals were more likely to view physicians as advisors in their healthcare, and less likely to see them as these experts up on a pedestal. The beauty of that approach was those women were most likely to get critical screening tests that they needed in their care. You know, how can we borrow from that? How can we ask smart questions and be full participants rather than being led by the hand in workplace conversations? Some other communication kind of hacks that you can think about as you're approaching things peer to peer is avoid using qualifiers on your ideas. You know, I know it's been a hard year for the company, but I'm asking for. That's not a compelling way to make a request. At the same time, you want to avoid a questioning tone. Even if you are asking for something, make it a proposal and make it a statement. For all of these reasons, I'm requesting X. There's other things you can do to help advocate your position. You can make it a trial run in the eyes of your boss. You know, here's what I've laid out for you. Why don't you give me a try in this position or in this particular role I'm pitching? You can take a kind of assumptive approach. You can say something like, we've just discussed all the parameters. When should we get started on bringing me on board? We could ask for assurance. That's a great scripted kind of request by saying something like, so do I have your commitment? We could even make it a give. Would you like my help? Okay, imagine how these really influencing, powerful questions can take what you're proposing and just bump it up another level. As you are navigating the conversation and being a good self-advocate, I want you to think about leaning on powerful evidence. There's a great saying that says that which can be asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. So think about how you're introducing your ideas and talking to your colleagues, even in a meeting. You know, are you using things that are irrefutable, things like competitive analysis, industry news, relevant statistics? You know, you can even use your experience by saying things like, you know, based on my 20 years in the accounting industry, I've observed. Okay, or our company has historically done X. These are all things that allow you to make a really strong point rather than, well, I believe or I feel that this is the right path. Try using some of these. The statistics reveal, the industry forces show. Here's a best practice we haven't implemented yet. There's something else you should think about, and it's around respecting your resume. You know, I interviewed the 20 C-level women I mentioned, and one of them, the wonderful Barbara Krumsick, she's CEO of Calvert Investments. She said, I think it's important for women to respect their resumes. And in her case, she will try to weave into conversation that she has multiple math degrees, that she served on a national development team, right? And you think about how compelling that is. You know, I have two math degrees. I can assure you I've looked at these numbers five different ways. What a great way to respect your resume. Let's talk a little bit about getting resistance or pushback to your idea. This often happens in the room, and it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. How will you handle it? One of the best things you can do, and I love this, is to be curious when you're getting pushback. So have questions at the ready. Train yourself to ask questions like, oh, what's leading you to that conclusion? Or can you tell me more about how you got there? These are, you'll notice, deepening questions. They are the opposite of dead-end questions that tend to invite very curt, surface-level answers. you know, deepening questions really peel the onion to get to the issue behind the issue that somebody is bringing up. So you're asking questions like, can you say more about that? Or I'm not getting a read right now on what you're thinking. What are your thoughts? Something else you can do as you're navigating the conversation is to ask yourself if you're de-risking it. I often ask women when I'm running sessions and talking to them about de-risking their proposal, I'll ask the group, does anyone know what they called the first cars in the US? And the answer is horseless carriages. We called them horseless carriages because we were used to horses. We were afraid to introduce something that felt too new. And you'll see that across multiple industries. Even today, we talk about what's familiar. We connect our new thinking to what's familiar. And you should do the same. How can you de-risk it? How can you explain when you're asking for more responsibility? You know, I already serviced this client informally once or twice. So by letting me own the account totally, we're actually not changing that much. Very smart way to take any jeopardy or danger out of what it is you're asking for and make it feel like actually it's a natural extension of what we're doing today. There's a few more things I want to talk about in the room. One of them is insisting on objective criteria. You know, I mentioned that it's not a question of if you'll get pushback, it's when. And sometimes you're going to get this vague kind of unclear dismissal or pushback. And so it's really important in that case that you insist on some objective criteria. And Fiza Jaffrey, she's a COO at Morgan Stanley that I interviewed. She really likes to ask for specific illustrations of somebody's objection. So she'll say something like, what exactly did I do wrong and what can I do to fix it? She said she doesn't mind even making people feel a little uncomfortable, putting the person on the spot and asking for very clear feedback. I would encourage you to do the same because there's nothing as disheartening as hearing a no, as one that's vague and hard to take action on. If you find you are dismissed in the room, this often happens in a group situation. You're getting jangled by a rude or demeaning person. Wait till they take a deep breath and then jump in. That's your chance. Sometimes there's a way to strategically interrupt when you're being talked over, and you can jump in with yes and. Sometimes if you don't interrupt, you're not going to get to speak. So speak up quickly, take that opportunity, acknowledge what the person said, and build on it. The last thing I want to say about in the room kind of behavior is there's certainly going to be times where you are dismissed just rudely and abrasively. I would articulate that demeaning behavior, and you can do it through allies, having allies in the room who you say to and contract with in advance. Hey, if you see me being shut down or talked over, you know, will you come in and share your thoughts about that? You know, you can do that pre-socializing. But I also think it's important to do it yourself. One of my favorite things to say is that sounds dismissive when somebody else is kind of waving away my thought. I want to move to following up. Okay, you've prepared carefully. You've really gotten in the mind of the person you're going to be negotiating with or advocating with. You've done a really great job of de-risking your request and putting it in their language. Now, you know, you're sitting with your answer. And I want to talk about following up because one of the best ways to employ a resilience mindset is to train yourself to hear no as not yet. Rosemary Turner, she is a president at UPS who I interviewed, was told very flatly, you are not president material. Months later, she became a president at UPS. Okay. And part of that came from her own self-belief, you know, not buying into what she was told, but also getting that specific information. Same thing with Dee Dee Wilson, a CFO at Nike, who I interviewed, who talked about, you're not quite ready to move into this role. That is what she was told. And she asked for specific skills that she needed to muscle up on in order to move into that role, which she did. How can you turn a no into a yo, which is what I like to call them, you know, that no into a kind of yes answer? Sometimes no is the greatest motivator on earth for a lot of us. So don't see it as a negative. I think that's the first thing, is change your mindset about what no means. Jody Glickman, she is a communicator and an author. She told a great story, and she said that she applied for her MBA at Northwestern. At the same time she applied for admission, she also applied for a Park Fellowship, which covers your entire MBA. And anybody who's been to business school knows that that is not an inexpensive undertaking. Well, Jody was very happy to get her congratulations letter that she was admitted to the school, but she did not get the Park Fellowship. Having that self-belief, she called the director of the fellowship program the next day, and she lobbied for it. And due to that phone call, she was an awardee of the Park Fellowship. She got an entire free ride within her business program because of choosing to make a phone call. I want to give you one other story that I think is important, because this is about when we tell ourselves no. Maybe somebody else is giving us a kind of light no, or a vague no, or just no kind of optimism. But what about what we tell ourselves? This story comes from Gina. She was working as a hospital doctor, and she hated it. She was very clear that this is not the career for me. This is not where I want to be. She really wanted to move into industry and work in pharmaceuticals, which was a better fit for her. Well, a friend helped her get an interview at a pharma company, and she was told pretty directly that she was an underdog, and that the fact that she had zero experience in pharma made her competition look even better, who came right from pharmaceuticals. Well, she decided to bet on herself. And she realized she had one chance to make this work, and a miserable future, frankly, in front of her if she stayed at the hospital. She overprepared to the point that she could give her interview answers in her sleep. She even had to do a PowerPoint presentation for this interview. And she made up her mind, if I'm not going to get this job, it won't be because I was underprepared. Well, she killed it. She did a really amazing job. And the other person happened to tank on their presentation. So yes, they had the experience, but they barely prepared. She got the job, and she could have told herself no. Think about how many times she could have told herself no before they did, but she didn't. You know, in closing, I want to ask you a question. Have you ever had the realization that very little happens just naturally? That very little happens just on its own. For men and women, happiness over our lives is U-shaped. So that's to say, we are happiest in our 20s and in our 50s, and we're lowest in between. I argue that to live with better conditions in the middle, we need to advocate. We need to advocate for jobs, for home lives that really work for us. Realize in your career that power is about 20% conferred and about 80% taken. That means good things don't come to those who wait. They come to those who ask, who advocate, and who push.
Thanks, Selena. That was great. We have time for just probably one or two questions, so let me jump right in. Can you address the subconscious fear that may hold someone back from speaking up for herself? What is the worst thing that can happen as a result of pushing back?
You know, the first thing I would say is very little in life is irreparable. You know, I think so many of us as girls and women can relate to being raised with maybe a belief that relationships should trump our personal agenda. And that is not the case at work. You know, that kind of thinking can paralyze us into not taking action because we want to tend and befriend, you know, over and above asking for what we need. Often, I would say the absolute worst thing that happens from standing up for yourself is that people think you have self-belief, not a bad thing. If you're asking for something, you know, they tend to think you want more from life than what you have today, also not a bad thing. Often, the greatest thing is that they see you as more of a straight shooter and more of a direct person, you know, somebody who says what they think and is looking to problem solve it and solution it. Those are not negatives. So I would encourage anyone with that mindset to reframe it. See yourself as that direct, straight shooter who asks for what their needs are and gets them met.
Great. Well, that is all we can squeeze into 30 minutes, so we'll have to end there. As a reminder, this teleclass will be posted to the conference websites as a podcast. So if you want to listen again or share with a friend, keep an eye out for an email from Eventbrite letting you know when that's ready. And Selena Rezvani, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was great, Lindsay.